Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. John Diederich is one of the Australian theatre's greatest and most versatile talents, having contributed to the industry across many platforms as actor, writer, director, and producer. John commenced his career at age 11 with J.C. Williamson's appearing in the classics Camelot and then Oliver, playing the Artful Dodger. At the age of 19, John produced and directed his first musical, presenting Minnie's Boys, a musical based on the life of the Marx Brothers. In a stellar career, his roles have existed in musicals, plays, television and film, subsequently allowing him to circumvent being defined by a particular genre, instead embracing a creative journey of terrific invention, considered choice, and pursuit of excellence. Mr. Diederich is responsible for one of my most treasured evenings in the theatre, the musical Nine, a smart and sophisticated slice of musical theatre that examines the creative process and the investigation of self, a show he produced, directed, and played the leading role. John Diederich takes such feats in his stride. He is the ultimate showman, and Stages is delighted that he is our featured guest in this two-part conversation, exploring a life in the theatre.
Hello, John. Give me just a
hello, voice. Peter. Yeah. A little voice level. Is that all right?
Yeah, it's great. You've got a nice resonant voice, so it picks it up. John Diederich, I'd love to start this conversation by showing you something and seeing what memories it might... might bring up.
Yeah. Well, lots of memories, obviously. I was 11 years old, and it's Camelot. And, gosh, I did it. I was one of the three little boys, and we...
There is a photo there of a young boy. Is that you?
No, I think that's Michael Crosby.
Right.
Who was Donald Crosby's son.
Right.
And Don Crosby was a very good actor and president of Actors Equity for a long time. Mm. He was in it. I remember being madly in love with Jacqueline McKeever,
right,
who was playing Guinevere, who was quite stunning looking. And Paul Damon was a terrific King Arthur. And the thing was, it went for nearly a year in Melbourne. So that was a long time for a little boy to be... I used to, in those days, just get on the tram from Middle Park and take myself into the theatre and do the show and then get on the tram and come home. And I did that for nearly a year. So it was it was important in that in those days, all of the principals were imported from overseas. Mm-hmm. Paul Damon and Desmond Walter Ellis played Pellinore. The original Lancelot was a man called Tom Larson, and there was a terrible tragedy. The show had opened in Adelaide, and he was driving home. His wife, I think, was pregnant, and he was driving home in a rush after the show to be with her, and he was in a car accident and he killed two people.
Oh,
dear. And so he resigned from the show. It was a shocking tragedy. And so Robert McPhee took over the part of Lancelot. Otherwise, it would have been an American playing that. And Jacqueline McKeever was an American player. And the only Australian playing a principal was John Ewing, who played Mordred.
Mm.
And I remember as a little boy thinking that John Ewing was better than all of them. And I couldn't quite understand, if one Australian was so good, why couldn't they have had Australians playing all the parts? And it stayed with me all my life, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Because what year was that, Camelot?
1964.
64, so yeah.
That's just the way it was in those days. J.C. Williamson's were an enormous theatrical organisation, as we know, and we were lucky that they brought out all the great shows straight from either New York or the West End. And we were lucky with that, that they got John Truscott to design it, because he hadn't designed the original on Broadway. But in those days, all the principals were brought out from overseas.
And Truscott designed the film too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah. Because of that production. Right. I mean, it was a stunning production. Yeah. I mean, the sets and costumes were just out of this world. I mean, he was a great talent, that man.
Yeah. Look, the Pajama Game, I think it happened by accident that they happened to cast Australians.
Yeah, well, Tony Lamont was pretty fantastic.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. But I think there was some sort of hold up with something. It was just post-war. And yeah. So I think Pounder suggested, well, let's put an Australian cast in.
Yeah,
there.
Oh gosh, how revolutionary. Yeah. But yeah, look. It was just the way it was, and we'd been conditioned to think that was the way it was. But, you know, I think little things like Ewing being so wonderful as Mordred, it would have to make an impression on people, you know, the powers of people. Well, maybe we don't need to keep bringing these people out from overseas. And it gradually started to diminish. And then, of course, Jill Perryman played Fanny Bryce. That was a huge thing, and she was so good. And then Nancy Hayes played Charity. And that was the beginning of us getting control of Australians performers being put into musical major roles. And why would you go back when you had those two fabulous women being so good in those parts? Why would you go back to bringing some? I mean, I won't mention names, but there were certain people brought out here to play certain major roles who really were second rate.
Yeah,
you know. And then we saw first rate Australians.
Well, I'll probably be the understudy on the tour.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I'm not going to say who, but there's two names who ring right in my and I saw them, and they, you know, and yeah, we were lucky that we had people like Jill and Nancy and Tony Lamond to just show and Gloria Dawn, and you know, they were just
great.
They were fantastic. And then
stars who do eight shows a week.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then on the male side, people like Louis Fiander.
Yeah. James Smiley.
Yeah. I mean, Lewis came out here to do 1776 because he'd done it in London. Mm. I was at university that year and I went and saw it. And it's still one of the greatest performances I've ever seen in a musical. I saw it seven times.
Wow.
And funnily enough, the man who wrote the book for 1776 wrote the book for Titanic, Peter Stone.
Peter Stone, yeah.
He always, you know, that sort of quality. I mean...
Because the book is very important in a musical, isn't it? Well, so many fail if they don't have a good book.
They all fail if they don't have a good book.
One of my favourites, magnificent score, is Rags.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, one of the three performances,
But it was good. It was good. And I saw it with Teresa Stratus was on, but she's not on the recording.
No.
Julia McGinnis is on it. But, yeah, and Judy Kuhn was fabulous, yeah. And Larry Kurt played the male, well, it sort of was a male lead, but it was, but a really interesting story. I mean,
Dick Latessa, too, played the father.
Is that right?
Yeah. So how does an 11-year-old become involved with JCWs and score that part in Camelot?
Because I had gone and auditioned. My sister loved the theatre, and I'd gone to audition for Oliver when I was 8 years old. It was originally put on in 1961 with Johnny Lockwood and Sheila Bradley, and I got cast as Oliver. But the Victorian government wouldn't allow me to perform in it because I was too young. I think the cut-off age in those days was 10. You weren't allowed to... And I still got the copy in my scrapbook of my father writing to Arthur Ryler, who was a miserable, horrible old right-wing Attorney General of Victoria, because he was responsible for that, begging him to change the rules, but he wouldn't. So I didn't get that. And, of course, it went on and it was fabulous. But then Terry Vaughan, who was the casting director at the time for J.C. Williamson's, remembered me, and they asked me to come in and audition for Camelot. And I did, and, you know, did it, as I said, for the 12 months. And then in 1966, Oliver was revived, and they asked me to come in, and I was hoping that I would be up for Oliver again, but I was far too unattractive and old by that stage. So they cast me as the Artful Dodger, which is a better part anyway.
Yeah.
He's got more gags and he's got a better song.
Better song, yeah, absolutely. And that was with Lamond, Tony Lamond.
It was indeed.
And Richard Wordsworth.
Richard Wordsworth, he directed it, and and played Fagin, and Terry McDermott was Bill Sykes. Roddy Dunbar was Noah Claypool. Tony Lamont was just sensational. Just perfect.
And some 50 years later, that ABC show, the recording studio, did you see her get back and perform with an orchestra singing As Long As He Needs Me?
Oh, I wish I had.
It'll be on YouTube. I'll show you after the chat. After the chat.
So well, she used to just... She used to absolutely kill that number every night.
Yeah.
And of course, it's just... it was a tragic time for her because that's when she lost her husband and unfortunately she left. But then we had Lola Nixon, who was also fantastic, who came in. Because the show had just been put in as a filler. Because, Williamson's had all those theatres and they had to fill them because they had the whole circuit of the whole country. And they had a four-week gap at the Madge in Melbourne. So that because they had the set of Oliver, because it was a wonderful Sean Kenny set with Revolve. Stunning set. But they had that stored somewhere. So they thought, we can put on Oliver for the smell of an oil rag, let's put it on. Well, they put it on for just 4 weeks at the moment and it sold out. And of course, as a little boy, I thought, that's the way the theatre is. You come to work every night and you play to these full houses. Little did I know. then they brought it back several months later and unfortunately used me again with another two boys to alternate playing the Dodger. And unfortunately, Tony wasn't with it anymore, but Lola Nixon was terrific as well.
It's amazing the number of blokes who were workhouse boys at some point. Yes. Went on to have careers.
Yep.
Nick Enright and Tony Sheldon and yourself.
Andrew Guild was the original Artful Dodger and the one that I was hoping that I would get into. He went on to be a very good producer. They're wonderful parts for kids.
Yeah. And this is a time also before any acting training in Australia, NIDA or VCA or WAPA.
Yeah.
So J.C. Williamson's was effectively your school.
It was. Yeah. And it was a great place to be because there were good people. Brian Buggy was the musical director, beautiful musical director, taught you an enormous amount. There was Pounder there, Betty Pounder there. Terry Vaughan was just the loveliest man, and ended up running the theatre in Canberra. And we took the 20s and all that jazz there many years later, So you were dealing with... And John McCallum was running J.C. Williamson's at the time of Oliver. And he was a wonderful general manager and who believed in Australian talent. It really impressed me to meet those people as a young kid,
Was it a theatrical household? I mean, you said your sister was interested.
My mother was very theatrical. Yeah. My mother was Rosalind Russell.
Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. She was Arnie Mame. She wasn't Mama Rose. She was Arnie.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, she was. She was Mama. She was Arnie Mame for sure. Oh. And she was just a wonderful woman.
This is June.
June, exactly. And I look back on it. I think a lot of my performing was because she liked it.
Had she been an actor? Or
no, she had a great voice.
Yeah.
But she loved my father, and she loved being a mother. I'm getting a bit teary. When she came to see Oliver, she wrote me a note and she said, "Thank you, my darling, for the most wonderful month of our lives."
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Yeah. No, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what matters, our parents' approval.
Yeah.
Especially if we're going into this business.
And I mean, and music, she loved music, she just loved it. And she, she was a great mother.
Did you have cast recordings at home?
Yeah, always. All right, always. So. She loved it. Whenever a cast would come out, those were in the days when, scores were really important, when somebody wrote My Fair Lady or Camelot or, Oliver, Sweet Charity, Funny Girl. You listened to the music. The music was the most important thing. The score was the most important thing.
And you would wait several weeks
that's right.
for it to arrive from the States.
No, nobody was streaming
no
that.
No streaming, no. That's amazing. So effectively, it's in your DNA. I spoke to Natalie Mosco recently and asked her, when did it all start for her? And her reply was, well, I think I was John Dietrich with brown hair. So for as long as you can remember, you had aspirations to be an actor or...
I guess I did. I mean, I do remember walking into Her Majesty's Theatre and and smelling it and feeling completely at home and loving it. Yeah, I do. I remember that as a 10-year-old.
And you'd be taken to see things too, I guess, by the family?
Well, we weren't that rich.
Right.
Okay. So we didn't... If we got free seats, we used to go.
Yeah.
My sister used to take me more than... I mean, we were a struggling family, you know. Mm. We just didn't really have the money to go.
You're at Melbourne High School.
Yep.
Was there an arts program there?
Yep. Wonderful people. David Niven was the drama... he was the teacher of English literature, and he did the school musicals. And Brian Corliss and Bruce Wallen was the musical director, and they were fantastic for me.
So what sort of repertoire were you exposed
to? I did Patience for them. I played Grosvenor in Patience. And then I did... Giuseppe in The Gondoliers, and then I played Jupiter in Orpheus and the Underworld. They were the 3 years I did the operas for them.
So operetta. What about any plays that they were doing?
They were doing plays then. After I'd left high school, they did do a play. I think they did a play and a musical. But those three were really a quality. You know, if they hadn't been teachers, I saw Niven. Niven was a fantastic actor. And I saw him do Summer of the 17th. I'll play Roo at the Melbourne University 1 year. And he was absolutely magnificent. And then I got both Niven and Corliss to be in Minnie's Boys with me there, which was great to get them working with, you know, to work with me after I left school.
I've heard about this famous production of Minnie's Boys for many years. I'm curious now, tell me, how did Minnie's Boys enter your life? When did you first become aware of the show?
Well, I'd always loved the Marx Brothers, and I'd done an illegal pirated version of Man of La Mancha as a kid and called it The Quest. I told Michael Edgley this and John Robertson in their office one day, and they nearly fell off their chair. So I'd had that bug of wanting to put shows on. And so I thought, well, next show I do, I better make it legal and get the rights to it.
Let's just go back to Quest, because I did read The Quest in your credits, etc. Yeah. I thought, what is that? But it was a bastardised version of...
No, it was the version.
The version, you just changed the name.
I went in with the tape recorder and taped the whole show and then wrote out the script. Someone went backstage and knocked off the props list from the thing. And so we did the show exactly as they did it. Because I thought it was one of the greatest pieces of musical theatre I've ever seen. Yeah. And it was completely irresponsible, but I was only 17 and I didn't know that I didn't know I was carrying on like a dickhead. but I loved doing it. Charles West and Susan Steele in the original production here, and Terry McDermott was in it again. He played the innkeeper. It was just mesmerising as a young music theatre person to see that. That to me was what musical theatre I wanted to do, you know. So we only did it in a church hall for like I think three performances or something, but it gave the bug in me and said, yes, the next thing I wanted to do.
You played the Don?
I played, yeah, at 17 I played the 65-year-old Cervantes and Don Quixote.
What's about time you did it now?
What a precocious little pain I was. But anyhow, my sister played Aldonza. It was just the local church group.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
It was, anyhow, we had a good time, we got away with it. Thank God we weren't sued. And I suppose I only talk about it publicly now because I actually did sit in Michael Edgley's office, who was running J.C. Williamson's, and told him. And it's, he nearly fell off his chair. Couldn't believe it. And I think he said to me, John, I'll give you some advice. Don't do that again. There was a company called Metro Media who used to license plays, and one of them was Minnie's Boys. And I asked them to send me out the material, and they had the album, which I just loved. And then read the book, and I just loved it. And so I said, and I got the rights, and we were going to put it on. And then I was accepted into the director's course at NIDA. And then Minnie's Boys, we couldn't get the theatre at the time we wanted, and it was postponed. So I had the choice of either going and doing the director's course of NIDA or putting Minnie's Boys on. And I guess I changed my path of my career by deciding to do Minnie's Boys. Whether it was right or wrong, I don't know. But
don't you love those sliding door moments? Yeah.
It was. Because if I'd gone and done the director's course, I would have hopefully I would have graduated and moved into probably into the subsidised theatre and been a stage manager for a while and then an assistant and then maybe, you know, a director in more in the subsidised. That's where that path led if you were successful.
Yeah.
But
it's
where I
had a desire to perform.
Well, I don't know why I didn't. I would have loved to have gone to NIDA.
Hmm.
I think I do know. I remember that I asked them, "Can I defer it for a year?" And they said no. So that was my hope, that I could do Minnie's Boys, and then come to. But they wanted me. They wanted me to reapply. I couldn't just defer it. I had to come and reapply. And I just went, oh, well, I'll worry about that in 12 months' time. I'll get Minnie's Boys on first. And then after Minnie's Boys went on, then I started getting work as an actor and I didn't think about it again.
Yeah, yeah. Your sister played Minnie.
She did, and she was marvellous.
Yeah.
She was nepotism, but marvellous.
Were Groucho?
I had no right to be Groucho. I was 6'1" and a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But I swear to you, when we auditioned and we could not find anybody. So I thought, well, I'll try and learn his voice. And I just listened to his recordings hour after hour after hour. And in the end, I kind of got it.
Fresh. If it's fresh, I'll take it.
If it's fresh, I'll take it. And so, yeah, I did it. And it was a great experience.
So you're producer, director, and...
Playing Groucho. Yeah. I wasn't the star. My sister was the star.
Oh, okay. Right.
I was a support player.
It's such a good show. I'm amazed it's never been done.
We tried to get the production company interested in it. And, anyway. Yeah, I agree with you, Peter. It is. It's got a lovely score and it's got a lovely heart and it's very funny.
Mm.
And it's got a nice conceit about it in that it is only the story of them as young boys. So you don't see them as the Marx Brothers until the very last number called The Act. It's a conceit because they pull all of the stuff out of the trunk and shove it on their heads and at the end of they go, well, Mama, what do you think? And there they are standing as the Marx Brothers. But I think that made it a much more interesting show, And there's a gorgeous song in it called Mama a Rainbow, which is just, that's real top quality stuff. And we had a beautiful guy called John Mount who sang it absolutely superbly.
Yeah. And in the piece, you had a young Michael Tyer.
He was the pianist. I gave Michael his first job. I didn't pay him, but I gave him his first job. And he was, well, you know, how lucky we were to have him. How lucky.
Yeah. I read you studied medicine for a bit.
I did, but that was not going to happen. I graduated from Melbourne High School and I got accepted in Melbourne University. And look, university separates the men from the boys. I didn't want to be a doctor. My father wanted me to be a doctor. And you can't fake university. You can fake high school, but you can't fake university. So I just went, after the year. They said, look, you can pick up courses next year and blah, blah. And I said, no, this isn't for me. And I put Minnie's Boys on.
Salad Days?
Yep.
St. Martin's?
That was my first professional job as an adult. Oh. Yeah.
With Ernie Bourne?
With Ernie Bourne, with the wonderful Tony Hawkins, who was a mate of mine until the day he died.
Ding Dong.
Denise Drysdale was in it, exactly. The beautiful little ingenue Carol Walker.
Now, that was directed by Jeff Warren.
It was, lovely
was he
man.
American that came out for The King and I?
He did indeed, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And his partner, Calvin, I can't remember his last name, was a lovely man. They were lovely men, both of them. And again, they taught great teachers.
And he stayed in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeff was a lovely man. Really, really gentle, lovely man. You know, man of the theatre, you know.
The only time I ever saw him was that production of Follies in concert that they did in Melbourne. Oh. Sheldon directed.
He played, I would have loved to see that.
I think
he would have played
Bring On Those Marvelous Girls.
Big Ten. Lovely man.
And Grease for Harry M. So these are your first shows.
When I was performing Salad Days at night, I was rehearsing Grease in the day.
Right.
And I vowed I'd never do that again. That's too much work. Even at 19, it's too much work. And then Denise Drysdale was in Grease as well. And then the wonderful Natalie Mosco was in Grease. And Tina Bursell was in it. And David Atkins. You know, it was just, it was amazing. But it was too early because Melbourne was still living in the 50s in 1972. So you couldn't have a show nostalgic about the 50s for a city that was still living in it. And it didn't work for... But I loved doing it. I remember we only played for 6 weeks at the Metro Bourke Street. And they said, well, we're closing the show. And I remember, I said, and when do we open in Sydney? And they said, no, we're closing the show. And I was crestfallen because I'd had that memory of Oliver. Yeah. I thought,
shows were like
all that. Shows went off forever, you know. Anyway. But I loved doing it. I loved it. But unfortunately, they cut my song out of the film, so no one knows my character existed.
Mooning.
Yeah. Roger. From Rydell High. Spent his days mooning over you. Very funny song.
Yeah.
Very funny song. And I remember auditioning for the show, because it was, you know, it was rock and roll, and I wasn't a rock and roll kind of performer. And I took in The Impossible Dream, which was very big at the time, I want you to know, as an audition piece. And the director, Jonathan Banks, who became a very successful actor in America, he said, what are you going to sing? And I said, I'm going to sing The Impossible Dream. And he came over to the piano, picked up the music and threw it in the dustbin. He said, I don't want to hear that shit. So I don't know what... I think I ended up singing Happy Birthday for him.
All right.
But I had the voice that he wanted, because the Mooning song was a big sort of... it was like a kind of... what was a crooner, of 50s crooner of that time? You know, like, and that's what he wanted. He wanted the big... sort of Jerry Vale kind of voice, you know? And that's how I was lucky enough to get in it.
That Jonathan Banks, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
That's it, yeah. So he was a good bloke. And Ross Coleman was the choreographer.
Right.
You know.
So was that your first meeting of Ross?
Yes. Yeah. He was Australia's Michael Bennett.
He was.
That's what he was.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And he was as exciting to work with as that. Because it was all original stuff. They didn't bring the production from America. And I remember that opening of the opening number. And Ross had this incredible capacity to stand in the rehearsal room with all of the cast there and create the dance on everybody. I mean, the pressure on... It didn't seem to worry him. I mean, I just thought, how is he coping with all that, you know? And he would just make it up like that. And every character he made different. You know, because that's the way he saw it. He was fantastic.
Was Harry M much of a presence?
No. No, I think I saw him twice.
Right.
And he came in once and insisted that Natalie wear white jeans instead of black so that she stood out. I thought, believe me, mate, this woman's standing out. She don't need no white jeans to stand out. She's gorgeous. I think that, and on the opening night I saw him, that was it.
Right.
But which I'm sorry about, because he was an enormous character, and funnily enough, I was just thinking, he came to see the opening night of Nine in Sydney, Harry Miller, and he came up to me at the party afterwards and he said, listen, son, he said, I know how hard it is to get these bloody things on, and you've done it. Well done.
Great.
You know, yeah. So I'm sorry we didn't get to see it. And of course then, I think he was probably in total crisis talks for the whole time it was on, because it just wasn't doing very well.
Right. What was Mr. Brodziak like?
He was larger than life, actually. He was he was somebody I had enormous respect for. He's the only person that I've ever met and worked with that I, right to the dying day, I called him Mr. Brodziak. I never ever called him Ken in my whole life. And I worked for him about four times. That's the respect I had for him.
Oh, that's great. Mm. That's great. Two Gentlemen of Verona, of course.
That show was fabulous.
Yeah, another great show which should have disappeared.
That's one of the few shows I'd love to go back and do again. I love playing the part I played. Eglamour was only a lovely song, fantastic, because he's talked about all through the whole show. He's going to come and rescue Sylvia, and everyone talks about him. And then finally he does arrive, and he used to come... down from the dress circle. I used to walk through the dress circle and come down a ladder onto the stage.
They had a good entrance.
With a white dove sitting on my shoulder, because they sent a dove off to find him. And so I had this white dove sitting on my shoulder. It was lovely. And the song was to the accompaniment of a cello and a tambourine and just your voice. And I loved it. And it was directed by Sammy Bays and choreographed by him.
Yeah.
And the show is so far ahead of its time because it was about all different nationalities and races living and working and loving and getting on with each other. That was the subtext of the show. That's how they, because it was written by the guys that had written Hair. So that was the, and it was a beautiful show, but unfortunately it had opened just after Jesus Christ Superstar, and I think that took all, that sucked all the air out of the, you know, what people wanted to go and see. They wanted to go and see that. And in the last couple of weeks of Verona, the audience has really picked up because it was a fabulous show. But I think it was too late, and they'd made the decision. I think they didn't want to take it. Because I think it would have done very well here in Sydney. I think Sydney people would have absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Fabulous dancing, beautiful costumes, great set. Terrific cast. Gilbert Price, who came out here, who was in the original Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd, voice to die for. I mean, you know, because he was the guy that originally sang Feeling Good.
Yep.
If you listen to him on the album, the voice was just as good when he came out here. My God, he could sing. Wow. And John Waters was fabulous in it, and Natalie took over from Rona McLeod, and she was beautiful. A woman called Gail Boggs, who was the black lady that played Sylvia, she was brilliant, but what a wild girl. It was fabulous. It was a fabulous show. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Around the same time, you're being recognised as a dramatic actor as well, back at J.C. Williamson's with The Man Most Likely To.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Lloyd George, and You're My Father.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to work with Ralph Richardson, and that was a treat. Absolute treat. Yeah. But unfortunately, I got a terrible bout of glandular fever, and I had to leave the show early, which was heartbreaking for me because he was a giant.
Oh yeah,
a giant. You know, and I got on very well with him, and you know, what he taught me. The one thing he taught me more than anything is how powerful stillness is on stage, because he would just stand there, and you couldn't look at anyone else but him. He wasn't pulling focus, just by his sheer presence. And when he moved for a reason, and he had wonderful posture. You know, and he had the fabulous voice.
Yeah.
And I remember he did a production of a one-man show of early days. I think it's a David Hare play in London. And I went back to meet him. I don't think he remembered me, but he pretended he did.
Yeah.
And I was doing Curly in the West End. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm playing Curly in Oklahoma." And he said, "Of course you are." You know, he took a look at me and went, "Of course you are." That was, you know, he was great. And Leslie Phillips was in a different thing altogether, much more commercial, but a wonderful light comedian. You know, again, working with him, that's what light comedy is. Okay. It's a different story, you know, but it's no less a valuable skill. It's a real skill to play that light comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, because The Man Most Likely To was just a trifle of a play.
Yeah.
But he made it, and the people loved him, and they loved it. It went on forever. I think I did it for nearly a year.
Yeah.
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 Because of him.
So still a time of imports from...
Well, he was a big star. Yeah, I mean, no one objected to that.
Mm.
No one... The show revolved around him. I never had any objection to that. And everybody else was Australian, and we were glad to have the work, and we were delighted to work with him.
Yeah.
It was the second raters that came out here, and the blanket principles. That was the thing that was wrong. Not bringing out big names. I'm all for bringing out big names. That's great, and still am. You know, because it was great for me to work with them.
Mm.
Great for all of us to work with them. You know.
So have you got an agent at this time, or is this the casting people that?
I had an agent very, very early on. I had the wonderful Beres Underhill at Frog Promotions, who was. He was the best agent I ever had in my life. Even in London and Sydney, she was the best agent I ever had. And unfortunately, she's no longer with us. And she was partnered with Philippa Pate, who was married to Michael Pate.
All right.
And they looked after me for... Beres looked after me for, well over 20 years. I loved her, yeah. She's the only agent... She was the only agent that really understood me as a performer. And so she knew what to put me up for, and you know, a lot of the things she would put me up for, I would get, because she knew that she didn't send me for things that she knew I was wrong for. That's to me is a quality an agent's got to have.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just you're torturing yourself, and you also diminish yourself. Do you know?
Yeah.
If you're going out for things that you're totally wrong for, just because the agent wants to say, well, you know, I sent you for this, I sent you for that. But Berris never did that for me. And she also, she would read plays, and she, there was one play she read, a thing called Wolf, that was on at the play box. And I just finished doing Les Miserables, and I wasn't the right, you know, play box was Malthouse by then, and they were kind of more avant-garde, and I was more mainstream. And but she went, John, this, you're perfect for this. And I went in and read it, and I got it, and that was only because of Berris.
That was a new play at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, by Tom Shalhoub. It was a terrific play, and Kim Durbin directed it very well. And but it was a meeting of different styles, but we all kind of got on in the end.
Yeah,
I think.
Insignificance is a great play too, playing the baseball player.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Susie Howie got me that part, right. The wonderful publicist.
Yeah,
she knew more about the theatre. She'd forgotten more about the theatre than most people will ever learn. And after Oklahoma, she said to me, "What do you want to do next?" You know, because she used to take an interest in everything. I said, "Oh, I'd love to do a play." And she went, Well, I think they're doing a play at the Playbook she'd be very good in. I'll mention it to them." And that's how I got it, from her.
Wow. Did you do it a couple of times? Was there a couple of productions?
I did it in Brisbane.
Right.
I did it in Melbourne, and both times I did it with Kate Fitzpatrick. Carrie LeGantner played the professor in Melbourne, and Gary Files was the excellent as the senator, and I played the ball player, and Kate played the actress. And then in Brisbane, Gus Mercurio took over as the senator, and he was brilliant.
Yeah.
And the wonderful Bob Hornery played the professor, and he was superb as well. And then I was going to do it in Sydney, which I would have loved to have done, but then I got Special Squad, a TV series, which I thought was probably better to do, but in hindsight, I would have been better doing Insignificance. Anyway.
You never know.
You make choices.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of other stars that came out and which you supported were Rex Harrison and Claudette Colbert in Aren't We All.
Yeah.
That must have been very exciting. And tell me about Harrison. What was he like?
I worshipped the guy.
Yeah.
I was to work with him. That was the most exciting person I ever worked with ever. He wasn't past it, but he was having difficulty. He used to have an earpiece in his ear just to make sure, because he would occasionally forget a line. But who cared?
Yeah.
The charisma was just unbelievable. The technique was beyond, it was just superb. The timing, the way he could deliver a line, you know, I just loved him. I used to watch him every, fortunately I had a couple of scenes with him. He was outstanding. And Claudette was just a beautiful person. You know, she wasn't in his league as terms of a stage actor, but she was still gorgeous. She was Claudette Colbert, for God's sake, you know. But I think she was more of a film presence. But the two of them were great together, and they had great rapport. But I was much closer with him, and I used to go and sit in his dressing room and talk to him and just try and suck him dry, you know. And I remember in Perth, we were there, and I went in and just having a chat. And I said, "Rex, I said, there's something, you know, that you've got that very few people will ever have in this business." And he said, what? I said, "Whenever anybody listens to I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, they're going to remember you, and they're going to do that forever."
Mm-hmm.
And he was really touched by that, you know, because he went, you know, he said, "Oh, thank you." He said, "You know, that's probably true, yeah, you know."
Because he had a reputation for being a bit prickly.
Rex?
Yeah.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
If he thought you could act, you were okay. Sue Lyons was in it. He loved her. Madge Ryan was in it. He loved her. He loved everybody in it, because if they weren't any good, they wouldn't have been in it. So he was very happy with it. But he didn't tolerate, no. He's Rex Harrison, for God's sake.
Yeah exactly. He can be.
He created My Fair Lady. He was prickly on Dr. Doolittle. So what?
Mm-hmm.
He was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I got no problem with prickly.
Yeah.
If they're good, and he was, and the thing about him, every so often, something would happen with him, And it would almost be like he'd flashback 30 years and he'd be the vibrant Henry Higgins. And this, you know, and you'd see it and you'd go, oh my God. But because of his age, he couldn't sort of sustain that. But you did see it from time to time, and that was really exciting. Mm. The flash would be there, and the verve, and the you know, the willing to perform without a tight, without a safety net. That was there.
Yeah.
I just thought he was that's one of the greatest highlights of my life.
It must have been a delight also to work with Louis Fiander, who was in that company.
Sorry, I forgot him, not because I mentioned him before.
Yeah, no, who Lewis, made such an impact on him in 1776.
I loved working with Louis. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and that's what I mean. It was a real stellar cast.
Hmm.
And Louis was a hero of mine. And we became good friends. And, I mean, why just, you know, when I did the play with him, you know, the first thing I said was, I saw you in 1776, and I think it's one of the greatest performances, which, of course, does help you become a friend.
Yeah.
Especially from an actor, when you tell them how wonderful they are.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he was great in it. Yeah. And the lovely David Goddard was in it, Peter Collingwood. I mean, it was just it was a stellar cast. Not a great play, but who cared? You saw Rex Harrison and Claudette Colbert.
Mm.
You know, that was enough.
Well, this is probably a good moment to tell you that you are responsible for the most exciting night I've had in Australia in musical theatre. I'm talking about Nine.
Oh.
We'll talk about Nine a little bit later.
Right.
But just such a special
Thank
show.
You, Dad. Yeah, thank you, Peter. That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
Well, it's obvious. That's the highlight of my career.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for me, without like the highlight in terms of working with someone famous was Rex, but to something that I did myself was Nine. Yeah.
And finally, Madge Ryan, which you touched on, she was your Aunt Ella in
the best Aunt Ella you'll ever find anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
She was perfect.
Yeah,
and so, she was so generous. Oh, what a beautiful morning! If you don't have a generous Aunt Ella, you've got no hope of making that number work for you. Because she's sitting there churning butter, right? That means she can do just about anything. She can pick her nose. She can. You know, scratch her bum, she, you know, and you're singing your heart out. And all, you know what Madge used to do? Madge would be there, the show opens and she's churning the butter. The second that she heard my voice off stage, she would just stop and she'd go like that. And she'd just cross her arms and listen.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye. And it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky.
By her doing that, she is telling the audience this is worth listening to before you've even come on stage. That's how generous she was, and that's how, I mean, I just loved her. And she took me under her wing because I was Australian and I was in London for the first time, you know. But, you know, that, do you see what I mean, how important that is as an actor to do that for another actor?
Absolutely.
And I can say when Madge left, the woman that replaced her, who will remain nameless, was not as generous. There was a bit of scratching going on.
That you were seeing.
But Madge was just fantastic.
Did that kid who did The Quest ever even consider that the West End, a lead role in a West End show, and indeed a Rodgers and Hammerstein revival, would be possible?
No.
Yeah.
No, it was just pure luck for me. We'd taken the 20s and all that jazz to Hong Kong, Bangkok and Dubai, and then my girlfriend and I wanted to go through Europe. And she met me in Athens and we stayed in Greece for a while and then we ended up in London and we'd met a guy called Barry Burnett who was an agent. We'd met him out here through a mutual friend of ours, Ted Dunn, who used to produce for Channel 10. And we just called him up, you know, we were in London and he'd said, you know, if you're there, call me up. We called him up and he said, oh, you must come and have lunch at Joe Allen's, you know, very exciting. Oh, isn't that lovely? It looks so theatrical. And this is on the Friday and he went out from the lunch and he came and he said, I've just got to make a phone call. And he came back and he said, when are you leaving? And I said, I'm leaving on Monday. And he said, can you stay until Thursday? And in those days, you could change a flight without being charged, you know, $19,000 in fees. And I said, yeah, I've got nothing to go back. And he said, because I've just spoken to Cameron McIntosh and they're looking for a Curly and they can't find anyone, but they're up in Scotland auditioning and they're not back until Tuesday and they want to see you Tuesday afternoon. And he was a very good agent, not as good as Beres, but he was a very good agent. And he organised for a pianist to take me through the songs on the Saturday, which I did. And I'll never forget a cleaning lady. I was in the, it was in the, which theatre? I think it was the Albury, which I think is now called, so I think it's called the Gielgud. No, I don't know. It was the Albury Theatre in those days. And I was singing with this guy in the pit, and this cleaning lady came to me and she said, you've got the loveliest voice I've ever heard. She said, so I thought, gee, I might be onto something here. Anyway, I went in an audition on the Tuesday, and I remember Cameron rushing up and saying, and Jamie Hammerstein was there, and like saying, people will say we're in love, and oh, what a beautiful morning, and read the script, and did scenes with this beautiful girl called Laurie, which unfortunately they didn't cast. She was gorgeous. And he came rushing up and said, do you have English parents, you know, because in those days you couldn't work there. And I said, no, I don't. And then, cut a long story short, they got permission from Equity for me to go in there, and that's how I did it.
We've been experiencing that in Australia for years.
So
that was sort of always the start, probably, of those negotiations between Equity and different countries to allow people to...
No, I didn't have anything to do. I mean, I'm told that Jamie... they didn't want me to come, and I'm told that Jamie Hammerstein went to them and said, if you don't let this fellow in here to play this, we're cancelling the production.
Right.
So, because, you know, I mean, Jamie was great to me, and if that's true, I'm very grateful to him.
Yeah.
But not particularly grateful to British Equity.
But the son of the lyricist, that's 6 degrees of separation, which was lovely. And I guess you got to meet the wives of Rodgers and Hammerstein.
I did. I met Dorothy, which is Jamie's mother, who's Australian.
Yeah.
So I met her several times, and on the opening night in my dressing room after in the Palace Theatre, I was standing in my dressing room with Mary Rodgers, Dorothy Hammerstein, Jamie Hammerstein there, all, you know, saying how great it was. It was pretty exciting.
Not bad reviews either. He has the looks of a movie idol, a voice that fills the theatre with any mood he cares to touch on, and a warm sense of fun. Every single song he sings ends in a richly deserved ovation.
Yeah.
That must have been nice.
Oh, it was.
Do you read reviews as a? As
yeah,
a
of course I do. Got a lot of people saying nice things about me. No, look, it was really exciting. Obviously, I mean, it's just, you know, you can't. You're just so lucky. It was luck that I got it. It was luck that I was there on holiday. I was lucky to be with Jamie, who looked after me. You know, knew how the role needed to be played. Stopped my indulgent impulses. Had Ray Cook as the musical director, who taught me more than any musical director I've ever worked with. You know, when you look back on it, these people are incredibly generous because they were prepared to really go out of their way to help you. And I think more than just what they were expected to do for the pay they were getting, especially Jamie and Ray. Ray Cook... This one lovely story with Ray Cook. I had my first music session with him when we were putting the show on in Leicester. We went on a long tour before it came to London. And I had my session with him and we did Oh What a Beautiful Morning. And then he took me through Surrey with a Fringe on Top. And there were two things. I embellished a melody in the... And he stopped and he said, you're not the composer. So we went back and did it again. And then I just did it exactly as he wanted and exactly as Richard Rodgers had written. And then he looked up from the... He was playing piano. It was just he and I. And he used to wear these glasses and he put the glasses down and he said, well, you were worth the fare. You know, they're lovely things that... You know, and especially when you're a young man over there and it just gives you confidence that you think you're in the... You know, that you can deal... That you're worthy of being there. Yeah. You know, so I... I'm extremely grateful to them.
This was the first big revival of the show, I think, anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it was.
So was it daunting taking on that iconic role, which, you know, had memories of Alfred Drake and Howard Keel and...
No, because of what I've just said, because Jamie and
all that support.
And Ray
and belief.
And Jemsy Delap was the choreographer who'd been in the original production. Mm. And she, you know, she helped me and, you know... I think also I knew it was a part I could play. Mm. I understood it. You know, what they liked, I know what Jamie said to me consequently was, I could sing it and I could act it, but he said, when you walked on the stage, it looked like you'd spent your life out in the open air, which I had, because I'm an Australian.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? The other time that Oklahoma was done, Curly was played by an Australian also.
Exactly, Hugh Jackman, exactly, yeah. And we do bring that American thing. If you're not going to use an American... Well, the next best thing is an Australian. You know, I mean, it is. I mean, Americans can play it. They know how to. Although, in a way, maybe Australians are better. Because we don't sort of bring any baggage to it. We just do it, you know. Whereas it's such an icon. Or nearly all Rodgers and Hammerstein shows are. But, I mean, you know. If you don't know all the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, you shouldn't be in musical theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's the grounding.
There's the Shakespearean that's text right. That's of music theatre, right. Aren't they?
They are exactly that. They are exactly that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about George and Ira Gershwin?
Well, I didn't end up well with them.
Right. Because we're talking about those shows that you developed and wrote with John O'May and Carolyn Gilmer and Natalie Moscow.
That's right. Well, we did Gershwin, and unfortunately my improper recognition of people's creativity came to bite me again, because we did Gershwin and all we were doing was paying for the song rights. And there's a thing called grand rights, which if you impinge on, you've got to get permission from the estate, right? I think you're allowed to do 5 songs and just pay normal, and that's what we were paying, the normal... But we were singing 30 songs. So when they found out that we were doing it, Ira got very upset with us and told us we had to close the show, and which we did. And they wanted all the box office receipts and things. This is when it went from the Midnight Show to the Total Theatre in town. And I remember saying at the time, look, because we hadn't made any money, I said, look, send them all the box office receipts. We've only made a profit of about $35. So they demanded the $35, so we sent it to them, and that was it. And they went, the show had to close,
right.
But which was unfortunate. But that was my fault. But the great thing was to see Natalie in it, who was just absolutely magnificent. That's all. She sang "Do It Again." She did the Judy Garland version, you know, with the coda at the beginning and the coda at the end, which is the most beautiful arrangement.
Yeah.
And Michael Tyack was the MD, and he just him playing the piano. And her singing, and she was in. Oh, it was just. It's a memory that I can see right now, and it's something I'll never ever forget. It's up there with Louis Fiander.
Yeah,
that's where it is with me.
But if you're going to create your own work, I don't want to call it a jukebox musical, but a review of someone's repertoire is the way to go, I think. And nothing had been done with the Gershwin's repertoire. We'd seen side by side by Sondheim, I suppose, and O. Cole.
Look, that's the point. I mean, George and Ira had done all the work, which is why they got upset.
Yeah.
But we got to enjoy it for a while, and we only ever did it out of love. You know, we loved the music, but they'd done all the work. It's their work. We were in the wrong. So you just go, I'm sorry, but I guess it's that old thing. It's what is it? It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. But we loved doing it, and Caroline was great in it, and John O'May was great in it. Another great learning process for us, you know. And also in a way to go out on my own a bit, you know, not to be protected by, you know, big J.C. Williamson things, and to actually go and say, well, look, I think I'm ready to go out on my own a bit, you know.
Yeah.
And it's music that it all started from the first time I heard Embraceable You by George. I thought it was the most beautiful tune I'd ever heard in my life. I still think it's in my top 5. And that's how it started. And I thought, I've got to hear more of this man's music. And that, as you go into the canon of George Gershwin, the songs are just divine.
Everyone's a winner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how was the approach to the 20s and all that jazz different?
We wanted to make sure we didn't plagiarise a composer's work. That's exactly what it was. Yeah. Let's not get into trouble like that again. Let's not get into those grand right things. Let's do a show where we can just get all, you know,
music from the period
and pay APRA their royalty, and then we'll be all right. And we were, and that's what we did, and that's how we came up with the 20s and all that jazz. That's honestly the reason. Just, let's stay away from those composers; they're trouble. and it was a good idea, you know. It worked because we great songs. You know, the whole decade had great songs, but where we made the show a success is that we put in three very serious pieces for each one of us to perform. I did the first one as Fatty Arbuckle. Then Caroline did a terrific Dorothy Parker monologue before she sang Drinking Again. And then John did a beautiful thing about an F. Scott Fitzgerald little short story at the end, talking about the 20s, and then sang magnificently What'll I Do, which ended the show. And then then we did the big medley. No, I can't read Salem, but anyway. But that what elevated the show above a cabaret.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, which really ostensibly is all it was.
Because you played Her Majesty's in Melbourne.
We did. Yeah, yeah. We did for Mr. Brodziak.
Right. Was that ever recorded?
Yeah, we made a recording, which is not very good, unfortunately.
Right.
We made a mistake with the recording because we should have made it virtually what we did in the theatre, and we kind of embellished it a bit. And it's all right, but it's not something I'm madly proud of.
I must dig it up.
Yeah, it's on. You can get it. It is on
YouTube, is it?
No. Well, it's on CD.
Right.
Yeah.
Someone will have it somewhere.
I've got a copy of it, but I must admit I don't listen to it very often.
Right.
And I mean, there are things about the show. A school wanted to do it a couple of years ago, and John called me up and said, "What royalty should we charge?" And I said, "Oh, for God's sake, zero. You know, come on, it's just lovely that they want to do it." I said, "But there's one proviso. No blackface," because I used to do Al Jolson.
Oh, of course.
And in those days, you didn't even care about it. No one worried. But nowadays, no.
Well, we didn't have that knowledge.
No blackface now. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, it was a different time, and you just say, "I'm sorry, I didn't know what I was doing."
What a treat to feature John Dietrich in this double episode of Stages. Join us for the companion episode next time. And don't forget, you can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by visiting our website, www.stagespodcast.com.au. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.